Thank you very much for that kind introduction, and thank you for coming to listen to the speech this evening. Somebody suggested that it might be useful for me briefly to explain how I ended up being a terrorism analyst. Not an occupation that you get up thinking that you will become when you're 18, necessarily. Anyway, it was all sort of a series of accidents, essentially. But when I was a student at Oxford, I decided to do a documentary about the Afghan refugees that were pouring into Pakistan as a result of the Soviet invasion of that country in 1979. The Soviets invaded Afghanistan, killed 1 million Afghans in the course of that decade, and made 5 million of them refugees. So in 1983, myself and a couple of friends decided to make a documentary about the Afghan refugees in Pakistan. We didn't know a thing about what we were doing, which was lucky, because if we'd known the problems, we would never have done it in the first place. But since we didn't know the problems, we did it anyway. And we made this documentary, as a result of which, at that time I was 19, I thought, since you've got to get a job, this doesn't seem such a bad one. They pay you for this to go to interesting places, so maybe this is what I should try and do. And as a result of which, I moved to New York, and I started working at ABC News as basically a sort of messenger, xerographer, gopher, coffee maker, and that's how I got into business. And then, as a result of an interest in Afghanistan and Pakistan, when the first Trade Center attack happened in 1993, having visited that country, it was clear to me that one of the key links of all the people who bombed the Trade Center in the first place was they all had some link to Afghanistan. They'd either fought there under people related to Bin Laden, I didn't know his name at the time, or they had some link to an Afghan center in Brooklyn. And so that's how then I eventually met Bin Laden. But I'll save some of that story for later. So that's sort of how I got into the business, the journalism business. And that's how I got interested in terrorism, which after all was a subject not many people cared about for many years. Of course, after 9/11, it became our major national security concern. A friend of mine who was, I think, the best journalist in the United States, a guy called John Burns, who won the Pulitzer Prize twice, was appointed some years before 9/11 as the New York Times' Islamic Affairs correspondent. And he said kind of an interesting thing to me. I called him on 9/11. He lives in England. And I told him what had happened. He said, "Peter, we're all Islamic Affairs correspondents now," which I thought was an interesting observation, because in a sense it's true. If you look at the media since 9/11, our knowledge and our understanding of the Muslim world has increased tremendously. We've had to understand it. But the subject of this talk tonight is globalization and terror, and I think an interesting subject to discuss. If you look at just before 9/11, the second anniversary, we had another audio tape and videotape from Osama bin Laden. And in fact, that's a perfect artifact of globalization. This was a picture of Osama bin Laden, who's a Saudi, and Ayman al-Zawahiri, who's an Egyptian, his number two, hanging out on the Afghan-Pakistan border. An audio tape was taken to Al Jazeera, which is, as you know, an Arabic language TV station that's spread all around the Middle East. That tape was in turn made available to CNN, who then broadcast it around the world and around the United States. Bin Laden's message, so these two guys sitting in rural Pakistan on the border were able to deliver a global message in the space of a few weeks from that tape being made, because of the globalized world we live in. And if you look at Al-Qaeda as a group, it would not have existed in the 1970s or the 1960s. It would just be impossible, because the group needed a globalized world to function. The group needed cheap air travel. The group needed more open borders, more immigration. The group also needed the internet to communicate. And the group needed 24-hour news organizations like CNN to get its message, or Al Jazeera to get its message out. Now, by which I'm not criticizing any of these. There's a debate about globalization, right? On the right, people say globalization is good because it kind of lifts every boat. On the left, people say that globalization is bad because it leaves people behind or exploits people, whatever. Now, my view is different from, in a sense, because my view is that it's perhaps informed with a sort of religious viewpoint, which is that technological advances are in themselves neither bad nor good. They are just advances. After all, the printing press printed both. Sorry, the printing press allowed Mein Kampf to be written, in a sense, but it also allowed the Bible to be written. So I think technology is neutral. And when we talk about globalization, which is, after all, a very nebulous word, I'm not even really sure that if we asked anybody in this audience, 10 people would have 10 different definitions. But in my view, it's about a series of technological advances, which are in themselves, either they can be both good or bad. After all, cheap air travel, the internet, more immigration, more open borders, to me these all seem like good things. Now, of course, a group like Al-Qaeda used those advances to do some very bad things. So it's impossible, as I was writing my book, I started thinking about this globalization thing a little bit. Because if you think about Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda is partly a response to globalization in the sense of westernization. That's partly a response to that, but it also uses globalization, the artifacts of globalization. I had a very interesting interview with, I went to Pakistan in 1999, and I met with a group called Harakat. They're called Lashkar-e-Toiba, and they're one of the premier Pakistani Kashmiri liberation groups. It's the nicest thing you can say about them. Terrorist groups is probably the most unpleasant thing you can say about them. I think we now would put them in the terrorism group category. Certainly the view of the US government is that they are a terrorist group. They've been put on the list. And I was talking to one of their spokesmen, and it was Ramadan, he was fasting, he offered me a cup of tea, we had this very nice discussion, and he was wearing a jean jacket, and he was also wearing shalwar kameez under the jean jacket, which are sort of Pakistani and Afghan national clothes. And as I began the interview, I noticed he was checking out the website with this Chechen rebel website. And I asked him, you know, you're opposed to the United States and its policies, and, but you use these things which are obviously that this technology did not, I mean, I didn't say this exactly, but obviously this technology emerged out of the Western context. And he waved his hand at the computers and the phones and blah, 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 and said, look, this technology is a good thing, but we reject the West. Which is a very interesting statement, because that, I think, represents the jihadists in general that I've either met or written about tend to be from very bright, they tend to be bright, well-educated people. Look at Ayman al-Zawahiri, the leader of number two in Al-Qaeda. He's a surgeon. He speaks fluent English. He understands the West rather well. Bin Laden comes from one of the richest families in Saudi Arabia. He studied public administration, economics at school. Again, rather bright. Mohammed Atta, perfect case, the lead hijacker, fluent German, PhD, and ironically enough, urban preservation. And obviously a very bright, and it came from a very bright family. Egyptian upper middle class, his father's a lawyer. So again and again, the kinds of people who are in these kind of jihadist groups tend to be quite sophisticated, and they understand the West rather well, certainly the technological side of the West. Now, there's a philosophical issue I won't detain you with too long, because it might be too boring, but there is a sort of epistemological question here, which is one of the reasons that we have all these inventions of work, airplanes, computers, etc., is because I guess we have a kind of scientific frame of mind which it revolves around doubt and self-questioning. And obviously the jihadists do not have a sort of a kind of self-questioning or doubting view of the world. And so I think it's somewhat ironic that they take advantage of these technological innovations to propose, after all, a kind of theology that would take us back. I mean, the Taliban, to them, are sort of rather heroic individuals. And certainly their aim is to impose Taliban-style theocracies around the Muslim world. That's certainly Bin Laden's aim, the people around him. I don't think there's necessarily a huge group of people out there hoping that will happen. But I will explain, I think, later why Bin Laden's ideas aren't resonating, at least some of them. So the audio tape that came out on the anniversary of 9/11 is almost a perfect artifact of what we're talking about, how the globalized world terrorist groups kind of take use globalization for their own purposes. As I was thinking about this speech today, it suddenly occurred to me there was actually a model for Al-Qaeda that I want to tell you a bit about, because it's sort of something that I don't think many of us know about, which is an interesting group. There was a group, and partly also because it's going to, I think it represents the future. There was a group called Amshan Rikyo, which was a Japanese cult, and their view of their kind of religion, if you could call it as such, was sort of a mixture of Isaac Asimov's Foundation series, married Buddhism, with a whole other series of sort of, and they created this cult that most people couldn't really understand. However, Amshan Rikyo developed tens of thousands of followers in Russia. They had offices in New York. They had hundreds of millions of dollars. They had a huge number of followers in Japan. And they started recruiting the brightest minds in Japan to do a weapons of mass destruction program, in which they experimented with chemical, biological weapons. And all this happened, despite the fact that it was a rather large organization, with the Japanese police doing very little, and with American Western intelligence agencies not even knowing what this group was, until a rather critical moment in 1995, when they deployed sarin, which is a chemical weapon, in the Tokyo subway, killing 12 people and sticking thousands of others. Now, the reason that story is, I think, important is because this Amshan Rikyo group, again, because of the democratization of information about weapons of mass destruction, which has happened recently within the period we talk about globalization, and also because they were able to recruit people around the world in Russia and in the United States and in Japan, really was the first terrorist. This group is really a model for the future. And I mentioned them, we know, I will talk obviously much more about Al-Qaeda since it's more relevant to our daily lives. But Amshan Rikyo was the beginning of something, and we perhaps should have paid more attention. And I think we will find that it's not the only group with an agenda that we can't really fathom, and a name we don't really know, that will be experimenting with weapons of mass destruction, but eventually will deploy them in this country, unfortunately. Because Al-Qaeda clearly has a strong interest in weapons of mass destruction, had a chemical weapons program, a biological weapons program, was willing to spend $1.5 billion to buy enriched uranium as early as 93. In fact, in December, a group of people in London, Spain, and Italy were all arrested. They all had one thing in common. They were planning to do a chemical weapons attack in Europe during last Christmas. Luckily, that was averted. There was also something called Jose Padilla, a Hispanic American, who was arrested in May in Chicago. We don't exactly know what the charges are against him, because even though he's an American, he hasn't been given a lawyer, and no one's told him what he's charged with. However, he may be charged with planning to some kind of radiological bomb attack in the United States. So Al-Qaeda had, like this Amshan Rikyo group, the Japanese group I mentioned earlier, Al-Qaeda had a very strong interest in weapons of mass destruction. And this is very unusual, because the previous model of terrorism was that terrorists were interested in killing very few people and having a lot of people watching. Because they didn't want to, you know, you kill a lot of people, as we've seen after post-9/11, you provoke very strong reactions against your group. And usually terrorist groups had a limited set of political goals. They wanted to attract a lot of attention to their cause without killing a lot of people. Now, religiously inspired terrorists seem to have a very different view of it. Somehow, if you're going to create heaven here on earth, killing a lot of people in the process, is not something you worry about. And with a group like Al-Qaeda, clearly all bets are off. They had this very aggressive weapons of mass destruction program. We saw on 9/11 that they had absolutely no compunction about killing as many people as possible. So that, unfortunately, is the future. And it's not just the future of Al-Qaeda. We've seen other groups who try to deploy chemical weapons. I'm trying not to be alarmist, because on the plus side, if you deploy these weapons of mass destruction, they wouldn't actually kill very many people, which is kind of the good news. Because if you look at the chemical weapons attack on the Tokyo subway I mentioned earlier, it only killed 12 people. If you look at the anthrax attacks in the United States, those killed 5 people. Now, each of those deaths is an individual tragedy, and it caused a huge amount of panic. So these weapons of mass destruction attacks would tend to be more weapons of mass disruption that would cause a good news. The bad news is that more and more information about these weapons are out there, and it's clear that terrorist groups, whether Al-Qaeda or other groups, seek to acquire them because it gives them a tremendous amount of prestige. And it seems that the previous restraints on using these kinds of weapons seem to have disappeared. Let's look at 9/11, since we're talking about globalization. Look at 9/11 itself. 9/11, again, is inconceivable in a non-globalized world. The conspiracy took place in Germany, in Hamburg. It took place in Malaysia, where there was a critical meeting. It took place in the United States, obviously. It took place in Afghanistan, where the ideas were hatched. There were money transfers from the United Arab Emirates. The people who flew those planes into those buildings came from countries around the Middle East, principally Saudi Arabia, but also Egypt and United Arab Emirates. So we're talking about a global conspiracy. So that it's very, very hard to imagine in an era of 20, 30 years ago to put that together. The second thing, of course, is that it will happen on live television, which didn't exist 20 years ago. And it not only did it happen on live television, it happened on live television around the world. I work at CNN. I started at CNN just before the Gulf War. This is a recent phenomenon. That was 1990. The whole concept of having an event that was seen everywhere. If you think about it, 9/11, if you go back to this idea of terrorism as theater, which is, that was the ultimate theatrical event. If you talk about propaganda of the deed, which is kind of how terrorism is seen by people who study terrorism, they talk about it as propaganda of the deed. This was the ultimate propaganda of the deed. So those pictures, again, could not happen in a world, in a non-globalized world. Let me go back to meeting Osama bin Laden in 1997, what he said and how it happened, because I think it's relevant to some of the issues we're talking about. Everybody in this room knows more about Osama bin Laden than I did in 1997 when I met him, although I didn't even know what he would look like. At that time, it wasn't really clear really what his agenda was. I produced his first television interview for CNN. And the reason I did that, going back to the first World Trade Center attack, I mentioned to you that I was interested in the first World Trade Center attack because so many people were linked to Afghanistan. And it was pretty clear that this was not just a bunch of sort of disaffected Middle Eastern cab drivers who decided to bomb the World Trade Center. There was a larger conspiracy out there. But it wasn't clear what. One of the criticisms of the Clinton administration's treatment of terrorism, which I think is somewhat unfair, is that it was only treated as a law enforcement problem. We convicted the four guys in the World Trade Center attack, case closed. I don't think that's really true. I think a lot of people in the FBI, the New York Terrorism Task Force, in the U.S. District, the Southern District of New York, the prosecutor the case, actually understood that there was a lot more out there. It wasn't just a law enforcement case. They were constrained by, of course, the usual guidelines. But they looked for a wider conspiracy. In fact, there was a wider conspiracy that was averted in 95. You may remember there was a plan to blow up the United Nations and bomb the Holland Tunnel and the George Washington Bridge. All that was luckily averted by the arrests of some 10 people in late 93. But going forward from the Trade Center attack, the reason that I got involved was bin Laden was at a certain point named an unindicted co-conspirator in that attack, which means that we don't know what to make of this guy's involvement, but he's involved in some way. And so after, in 96, the US State Department produced a very quite detailed document called White Paper about bin Laden, saying that he had training camps in Sudan and Afghanistan, and that he was financing Islamic extremism around the globe. So at that point, I went to my bosses at CNN and said maybe we should try and interview this guy, because perhaps he is the key to the first Trade Center attack. They said yes, and I went to London and I spoke to his media representative about interviewing bin Laden, and after about a week of conversation about Saudi politics, the Quran, etc., they were concerned, are you an agent of the CIA? Will you give us a fair hearing? And I assured them that we would give anybody a fair hearing. And after I went back to the United States, went back to Washington where I live, and about a month later I got a call saying, we're on, And I went back to London with a correspondent, with a cameraman, met with two of Bin Laden's associates, and we traveled to Pakistan, and then we waited for the green light to go to Afghanistan. We went to Jalalabad, Afghanistan, in the east of the country. We waited for 4 days. We got another visit from another media advisor telling us we couldn't bring our equipment because they were concerned our equipment might be concealing some kind of tracking device. Anyway, which was disappointing afterwards. Oh, I knew that our professional equipment would do a better job than theirs, but they said we would provide a camera. Don't bring even a watch, just bring the clothes you're wearing, and we'll pick you up tomorrow. So tomorrow arrived, a Kurdish minivan arrived, and in the minivan were three heavy armed men, not much conversation, and we drove towards Kabul. At a certain point, one of them said, if you do have a tracking device, now is the time to tell us, otherwise it will become a problem. And so I assured them we didn't have a tracking device, and we then drove up into the Afghan mountains. It got dark, we transferred vehicles, you can see how difficult it would be to find Bin Laden right now. I think this is now 97, when he was not the subject of considerable US interest. He was the subject of some interest. But even then, he was very careful about security. We went through three concentric rings of heavily armed men that were carrying RPGs, which are rocket-propelled grenades. They were carrying Russian submachine guns. And they were pretty professional. They searched us in a very professional way. They ran a device over me, which I had never seen, both myself and the cameraman and the correspondent, a kind of beeping device, which I took to be anything. If we were receiving anything electronic, it would have set off this device. Anyway, well, we passed all those hurdles. We arrived at a small hut. We had some kind of dinner, and we waited until Bin Laden arrived. And he arrived out of darkness around, I estimated it was around midnight. He's about 6'4". He kind of walks with a cane. He walks with a slight stoop. He was extremely low key. He was all business. He sat down. We had submitted a number of questions in advance. That was one of the conditions of the interview. He basically didn't want to talk about his personal life, his family, his finances. He wanted to talk about why he was at war with the United States, which is, after all, why we were interested in talking in the first place. And what was he saying that night? Why is he at war with the United States? But he's been amazingly consistent about it. A lot of people try to say he's at war with the United States because of our way of life, or because of our love of freedom, or the First Amendment. But he doesn't. Bin Laden never talks about American culture. He never talks about the drug and alcohol culture of the West, our tolerance for homosexuality or feminism, or any of the kind of cultural issues that people might ascribe to him. He only cares about one issue, as far as I can tell, the critical issue is American foreign policy in the Middle East. And in descending order of importance, on that night in March 1997, it was US presence in Saudi Arabia as a result of Operation Desert Storm, US support for Israel, American policy in Iraq, US support for Egypt, and Saudi Arabia, two countries that he thinks are not sufficiently Islamic. And he hasn't really deviated from those positions since. We asked him, okay, so you're at war with the United States, is it a war against American troops or American civilians? And he said it's principally American, he was at war against American troops. This was in 97. A year later, he would give another interview in which he said, I made the distinction between American troops and American civilians, and obviously he doesn't. So since then, Bin Laden's he has not talked about it. He's remained about our policies in the Middle East. That's his principal political beef. I'm not suggesting we should change him. I'm just saying that's why he's at war with us. The other issues, of course, which engage Bin Laden are, to a lesser degree, are the Indian occupation in his view of Kashmir, what is the Russian situation in Chechnya, and other conflicts around the Muslim world. But it remains that basically the American foreign policy is his principal gripe. Well, so in 97, I met him in the middle of the night in Afghanistan. It's the mountainside. Here's this guy in a turban saying he's declaring war in the United States. It seems a little improbable that he would actually deliver. In fact, I was asked back a year later to attend a press conference he was giving, and I declined because I thought, A, you know, why hear the same stuff all over again? And B, he hasn't really done anything. And so he appears to be a blowhard. Of course, that would turn out to be wrong. Shortly after that press conference, in which he told the press, the various Pakistani journalists there, you know, there will be good news in the coming weeks. Two US embassies in Africa blew up simultaneously, in fact, within 9 minutes of each other, killing more than 200 people. Now, it's quite hard to blow up an American embassy. If you look at most American embassies now, they're like medium security fortresses at this point. But it's 10 times hard to blow up two of them within 9 minutes of each other. And the reason I focused on this a little bit is the date. August 7th, 1998 is when those embassies blew up. Now, that happens to be 8 years to the day that President Bush announced that US troops would be going to Saudi Arabia for Operation Desert Shield, which became Operation Desert Storm. So this was not a coincidence. Obviously, Bin Laden was sending a message. Our response to that attack was to send cruise missiles in his general direction and in the camp in Afghanistan, and also to what turned out to be a pharmaceutical plant in Sudan. It turned out to be not a very effective response because the pharmaceutical plant was a pharmaceutical plant, not a weapons of mass destruction plant, and Bin Laden wasn't at the camp that he was supposed to be at. And then Bin Laden and Al-Qaeda went on to blow up the USS Cole in Yemen. Now, you're talking about getting to the theme of globalization. Just think about the countries where Bin Laden and Al-Qaeda have struck. Kenya and Tanzania, Yemen, Saudi Arabia, recently Morocco, Indonesia, obviously the United States. This is a very much a globalized network that is operated globally. When Bin Laden attacked the US warship, the USS Cole in Yemen, that was an unprecedented attack. This US warship, the USS Cole, is a Burke-class destroyer, which is the most advanced destroyer in the US Navy. Its hull is designed to withstand torpedo attacks. Bin Laden's suicide bombers blew a hole inside of a small house in the Cole, nearly sinking it. Now, that happened in October 2000, and the reason I'm talking about it tonight is because there is actually kind of a relevant political debate that I think is about to be joined about, did the Clinton administration do enough to attack Al-Qaeda? In fact, I'm reading a book right now which makes the case that Bin Laden, that the Clinton administration attempts to make the case that the Clinton administration did not do enough. My view is that the blame can go, you know, we can generously spread the blame all around, including the media. Let's go back to the 1990s. A lot of the television networks were closing down their foreign bureaus. Let's also blame the public, which after all is part of the view, who were tuned out of international news. It didn't matter how much international news put on, the public wasn't interested. There was a kind of complacency about where we were in the world, a belief that history had ended. The Clinton administration, after the Cold, did nothing. But the Clinton administration was only in office for about 3 months. And then the Bush administration did nothing for 9 months until 9/11. So I think that neither administration gets glowing marks for its response to the USS Cole, which after all, it didn't require a sort of PhD in criminology to realize that Al-Qaeda had done the attack, and Laden publicly boasted about it on video. In fact, the Al-Qaeda guy who was supposed to videotape the Cole attack fell asleep. And so the Al-Qaeda sort of propaganda arm actually imposed sort of with a graphic, this sort of fireball, when they put out their own videotape claiming credit for the attack. So it was pretty obvious that Al-Qaeda was behind the Cole attack, but we did nothing. And I think that's important for this political debate that is about to be joined about, because obviously this had little ramifications in the coming election. If indeed the Democrats sort of were asleep at the wheel, that would be a case that Republicans would want to make. But I think that, as I've said before, I don't think either administration distinguished themselves. And if you actually look, Ashcroft was rejecting money for terrorist related. People wanted to give him more money for terrorism. He didn't think it was that important. And I think when Condoleezza Rice came in, Sandy Berger gave her a briefing in which she said terrorism would be the most important thing. She couldn't remember the briefing. So I think the Bush administration obviously became very focused on the issue of 9/11, just as we all did. And I think the Bush administration did a fantastic job, actually, with the war in Afghanistan. Obviously, it's not perfect. The situation there is not, in the south and the east, is getting worse to some degree. But the fact is that there was a very strong response, perhaps the only response that could be made, in a war in which Afghan civilian casualties were relatively limited. We completely routed the Taliban. Al-Qaeda, which means the base in Arabic, lost its base in Afghanistan. They lost their dozens of training camps. This is very important. But Al-Qaeda has sort of emerged from Al-Qaeda, the organization, was severely disrupted by the post-9/11 world, certainly the attack in Afghanistan. There have been 3,000 arrests of Al-Qaeda sort of associates around the world. And so that has done a lot of harm for them. However, two things. First of all, I think they've morphed into kind of a more virtual organization. There are internet websites that Al-Qaeda runs that sort of squat on other people's websites, unbeknownst to them. A Dutch soccer club will have Al-Qaeda website on their site for a few days until it gets taken down. And so on these sites, you get Al-Qaeda sort of propaganda, but also recipes about having bombs. Obviously, that's not as effective as actually going to Afghanistan, learning at the feet of the great masters, but it is nonetheless quite useful. And we've seen Al-Qaeda since 9/11 is certainly not out of business. This may be a rather morbid way of looking at it, but since 9/11, Al-Qaeda or its affiliates have probably killed about 350 people, which is obviously a fair number of people. But that's not 3,000 people in 1 hour. That's 350 people in 2 years. So that's a kind of success. There have been no attacks in the United States. That's also, to me, a big sign of success. Richard Reid, the so-called shoe bomber, who had sort of the ultimate case of cold feet when he decided to blow up American Airlines flight flying from Paris to Miami. That was the one example I can think of a real Al-Qaeda plot that would have killed Americans. The rest of the people that we've arrested in Lackawanna, in Buffalo, New York, the people in Oregon, these are even people inside the Justice Department have said to me some Islamic group of Houthis, these are not sort of serious Al-Qaeda type people, which means one of two things. Either there are Al-Qaeda sleepers buried so deeply in this country they've not been found, or there aren't. And I'm now tending towards the latter view. I've talked to people in the FBI. Their view about the 19 hijackers is they've interviewed tens of thousands of people, and they've had the largest criminal investigation in history. Their view is the 19 hijackers didn't have support within this country. Anybody who offered this support did so unwittingly. So maybe our view is true. Bin Laden, there are three ways that you can get people on the run. One is somebody drops a dime on you because they're interested in picking up a cash reward. That is not the case with Bin Laden. There's been a reward since 99 of $5 million. It was up to $25 million post 9/11. So the people around him are not motivated by money. The second way people get you is there's a mole in the organization. Clearly, there's no mole in Al-Qaeda. There's nobody who can provide real-time information about where Bin Laden is. And thirdly, Bin Laden could make the same mistake that other people have made, which is chatting away on a satellite phone or cell phone or handheld radio, the kinds of things that National Security Agency can intercept. But he's not doing that. He's not talking on any kind of electronic device. So he's not doing the sorts of things to get people caught. Eventually, dumb luck, he may make a mistake, but that could be tomorrow, or it could be a year, or it could be 2 years from now. In terms of closing down the money supply of Al-Qaeda, obviously that's somewhat important, but not, I don't think it's ultimately important, in the sense that you can't persuade 22-year-olds to fly passenger jets into skyscrapers because of money, it's about belief. So I think that closing down the money supply, while somewhat useful, particularly useful as an investigative tool following the money, it's not so useful as necessarily closing down the organization. The question of the Saudis, I think, may become obviously a more bigger issue as time goes on. I think it already is becoming a big issue with the redaction in the congressional report of the Saudi role in 9/11. I have talked to FBI investigators who before the May 12th attacks in Riyadh that killed 25 people, I would ask them, how are the Saudis doing, cooperating with us in this investigation of 9/11? And the investigator said words like obstructionist and despicable to describe their activity, which frankly I was surprised by. I thought after 9/11, we know that in previous terrorist attacks that involved Americans and Saudi Arabia, the Saudis did not cooperate at all. But I thought after 9/11 they would. Is it not passing strange that 15 of the hijackers are Saudi, yet no Saudi confederate of theirs has been extradited from the Saudi Kingdom to the United States? Surely they must have had some kind of guru in Saudi Arabia, or somebody, some kind of, we've had people being on trial in Germany in a very public way who were involved in the 9/11 conspiracies, but we've not seen that in Saudi Arabia. With the attack in Riyadh that killed 25 people, I think that's changed. The Saudis seem to be more willing to crack down. We can only hope that continues. Is there, trying to finalize some of my thoughts, is there a solution in all this? It's very easy to identify problems, but identifying solutions, of course, is much harder. I think the extent to which there is Mohammed, who was the leader of the 9/11 plot, was arrested in Pakistan back in March. His arrest undoubtedly saved American lives, because this guy had been plotting anti-American attacks since 93. In fact, his nephew, Ramzi Youssef, was the guy who planned the first Trade Center attack in 93. He was planning to kill the Pope in the Philippines in 95. He was planning to blow up 12 American airliners in Southeast Asia in the mid-90s. So the arrest of this guy definitely made our lives a little safer. But arresting people, obviously, I talked about Bin Laden's and about ideology. You can arrest as many people as you want, but you can't necessarily arrest ideas. So at the end of the day, I don't think this is a cultural, fascist civilization. I think this is an ideological struggle. I think, which obviously, when I say we will win, I think the whole world will win, because I think there is a silent majority of Muslims who certainly don't want the Taliban-style theocracy in their neighborhood. They're not happy about American foreign policy, particularly in Iraq, but that doesn't translate into necessary support for Taliban-style regimes. But we have to be very careful about how we conduct ourselves to make sure that they aren't thrown in the arms of the radicals. The Pew Charitable Trust had a fascinating poll recently. One of the questions was, who do you trust more, Osama bin Laden or President Bush? And in countries like Indonesia, Morocco, Jordan, and Turkey, all of which are staunch American allies, overwhelmingly, people voted in favor of Osama bin Laden. And that's quite a disturbing poll. So if we lose the war of ideas, that is a big problem. Is there a solution? I think one of the simplest solutions, well, not simple, because it's not going to happen overnight, but a solution is obviously a more democratized Middle East. Now, one of the reasons we invaded Iraq, according to Wolfowitz and Pearl and the neoconservatives who engineered the whole thing, was if we had regime change in Iraq, that would magically produce regime change around the Middle East and create democracies. Now, I don't know if that's true or not. We're running the tape right now. All we can say is we sped history up. We didn't need to invade Iraq, I don't think. It was a voluntary war. It wasn't a necessary war. However, we've done it, so now let's find out what's going to happen. Now, maybe you will create democratic regimes around the Middle East. Maybe it won't. But that is what is required. Because if you think about Al-Qaeda, the people who run Al-Qaeda are Egyptians and Saudis to a large degree. And they come from societies that tolerate no forms of dissent, essentially. These are not open societies. If we had more open societies in the Middle East, there would be a place for Islamists to go. This may be hopelessly naive, but when I visited Yemen, there is an Islamist party which participates in elections. They may not want to create the kind of society that most of us would be happy about, but it is, after all, their society, not ours. And they are working in a peaceful way, in a democratic way. And so, if I can offer any solutions, I think that would be it. How you affect that, I don't know, but I do think there is one way that there's actually one thing that is absolutely vital, and I say that perhaps as a self-interested member of the press, but I've noticed in countries with a real freedom of the press, places like Pakistan, which technically is a military democracy, it's a military dictatorship, actually has a very open press. And that's a very good thing, because open press leads to criticism. And in the end, I think, and civil society. And in the end, I think Pakistan is actually going in the right direction, even though it's going through a military dictatorship right now. Could be going in the right direction. So, with that, I'd like to take any questions.
I don't know.
I think you're right to say that this was sort of predictable. How it all plays out, I simply have no idea.
What role do you think the madrasas play in terms of providing fertile ground for future terrorists? Is there some type of alternative education that we could help along?
Yeah. A very useful use of American taxpayer money would be to hand Pakistan money for its public education system, because and that would be the best anti-terrorist measure you could take, in a sense. It would not be very expensive. The reason people go to these madrasas is because the education is free and you get a free meal and there are no other alternatives. And of course these madrasas play a very significant role, I think, in recruiting people and merely teaching them about the Quran and Jihad. It's not true just in Pakistan, it's also true increasingly in places like Indonesia, where these schools are being funded by the Saudis. Baghdad may have met with an Iraqi intelligence agent in Prague before 9/11, but it seems now that both the Czechs and the Americans are saying it's not clear. In fact, the FBI and CIA is saying that Baghdad was involved and that this meeting is supposed to be happening. And in fact, we now have in custody the Iraqi intelligence agent he was supposed to be meeting. And I think that guy knows that his best get out of jail card is to mention if in fact that did happen, and he's not saying that. I think we know that if he was saying it. Secondly, there was supposed to be a meeting with a high-ranking Iraqi intelligence agent with Bin Laden in 98, a guy called Ejazi, who was the ambassador to Turkey. He's also in US custody. I think he knows that if he could mention the meeting, that it might be helpful with his present custody situation. I don't think he's saying it. So we haven't found a warehouse of documents proving the Al-Qaeda Iran connection in Baghdad, despite the fact we've been occupying it in large numbers for 4.5 months. I was very, very suspicious, skeptical of an Al-Qaeda Iraq connection before the war, and I remain so. And in fact, I spent 4 years investigating Al-Qaeda for my book. One of the striking things was how few Iraqis there were in the organization. There were a lot of Saudis, and there were a lot of Yemenis, and there were a lot of Algerians. There weren't a lot of Iraqis. In fact, in my research, there were probably more American citizens who were members of Al-Qaeda.
Yes, I have to comment on one of your suggested solutions to reduce terrorism in that part of the world. You suggested that maybe more democracy or more representative government, and that's a good idea. But I think a more important issue is the biased policy of this country toward the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And if you ask anybody in the Middle East, even a kid in school, will tell you that the U.S. policy in that part of the world contribute basically to the rise of fundamentalism. I think, in my view, if the United States take a fair view of that issue, it would be much less fundamentalism and anti-American views in that part of the world.
Well, certainly the Palestinian issue is, as I said in my speeches, Bin Laden's number two beef with the United States, and it's a routine. There's not a Muslim I've met or anybody in the Middle East who doesn't think the United States is biased in this case of Israel. That's simply a fact. And my view is the following, which is one can be pro-Israel without being pro-Sharon. I think Bush made a very serious mistake saying that Sharon was a man of peace. It was maybe an off-the-cuff comment, but it resonates in the Middle East. And the fact is that there have been moments when we have undertaken the peace process in such a way that I think that there was a hope. And unfortunately, it's a very intractable problem that won't be solved overnight.
Plans closed in 98 to actually attack and kill Bin Laden.
Yeah.
Do you think he was really crippled by impeachment? That was one of the things that didn't allow him to do that?
They didn't have the real-time intelligence, and they worried at some point. I think Clinton wanted him dead.
How much did that acquisition in the
cruise missiles? I don't think he was there at all. I think he was.
Thanks for coming out.
Thank
one of Dan's students.
Oh, right.
Wonderful.
Thank you.